see Judge King is participating with us today by video. First case this morning is 23-50632, United States of America versus Abbott.
Thank you, Chief Judge Richmond, and may it please the court. For most of its length and much of its storied history, the Rio Grande has been little more than a creek with an excellent policies. Nearly dry, except when it's a raging flood, ships have never used its sinuous, rocky, and ever-shifting course to transport passengers or commercial merchandise, except when it's now. Today, in the vicinity of the Old Pasadena, the water is admittedly more consistent, only due to irrigation infrastructure that further impedes water travel. Nevertheless, the United States alleges, the district court agreed, and the panel affirmed that the Rio Grande is a navigable river subject to the same federal controls as the Mississippi. If the U.S. is right, then any body of water would be deemed navigable and thereby subject to federal jurisdiction. If one, the United States Army, has ever investigated whether it can be navigated, two, it can be or ever could have been crossed by means of a boat, or three, it could, hypothetically, through the investment of potentially infinite resources, be made to accommodate a 19th century keelboat or even a load-bearing canoe. Because every body of water in this circuit meets one of those three conditions, that rule is irreconcilable with the fundamental bedrock principle of our federal system, reiterated most recently in Sackett, and I quote, that regulation of land and water use lies at the core of traditional state authority. And it is unjustified by the language of the relevant statute. It has for more than a century been interpreted to apply to waterways that in their ordinary or natural condition serve as the harbor of interstate commerce across which trade and travel can be or is conducted in the traditional or normal means of travel on water. Moreover, if asking this court to create Sackett Redux were not enough of an affront to federalism, the federal government also asks it to hold that a state must get a permission slip from Congress in order to take even temporary measures to protect its citizens from hostile entrants trying to enter its territory. Because the district court did so without even showing of the harm to legitimate commercial shipping, its order is far from equitable and should be reversed. I welcome the court's questions.
So one of the things that the district court decided was that the question of whether Texas has been invaded is non-justiciable. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with that?
It is not justiciable. I don't agree with the implications that the federal government has drawn from that.
Well, if it's non-justiciable, then Texas action would stand because it can't be judicially reviewed. And if that's true, then our case law says that a non-justiciable matter means that the district court has no jurisdiction. So this matter would be dismissed. I'm a little curious as to why, maybe you disagree with all that, but I'm a little curious as to why Texas hasn't pressed that issue. Of course, it's jurisdictional, so we have to consider it anyway.
We do agree with your assessment as to what that would mean. The federal government has asserted instead that because it is non-justiciable, that the district court cannot consider it and the defense becomes irrelevant. That's not what the Supreme Court said in Moyer against Peabody, which it said that the fact that the governor in that case, I believe it was Colorado, had determined that there was an insurrection that was sufficient and stood by itself. And that is along the lines Your Honor just listed, and that the text says does agree with.
Because, I mean, it would be sort of bizarre, wouldn't it, if Texas action stands because that's the constitutional power of the state, but that it could be overridden by the statutory power of the federal government. That stands everything on its head, it seems to me.
Yes, Your Honor, we would agree with that. And to date, the way the case has been litigated on the grounds of navigability because that's the way the United States has pressed this claim. But we do definitely agree with Your Honor that the district court cannot question whether or not there has been an invasion, that the governor's declaration that is dispositive under Moyer.
That would be the end of the case.
Essentially, yes.
What about the Supreme Court's decision in Zivotofsky versus Clinton?
In Zivotofsky against Clinton didn't address the insurrection issue entirely. The difficulty with the justiciability version of the invasion clause issue is that's typically raised where it is the claim that is being asserted is non-justiciable. Here, the question is that it's a defense that's non-justiciable, but this defense would be dispositive in this case, in our view.
Can we turn on the mic?
We know from Tugwell and Wild that ferry commerce, even illicit commerce, the reason for the buoy barrier, does cross the Rio Grande here.
In the 19th century.
So historically it has, and today we have 28 bridge and border crossings. And all but four states are divided by border rivers. So is your position legally that the Army Corps does not have authority to dredge border rivers between all but four states, and especially between Canada and Mexico, to allow for traffic, foreign commerce, interstate commerce that's necessarily across border rivers?
Not necessarily, and I'll try to speak up, Judge Jones. And this goes to the Oklahoma case, where the court determined that just because it is a boundary water does not mean that it is a navigable river within the purposes of the Rivers and Harbors Act. Now, there may be another statute or another power that would allow the Army Corps to dredge those waters, but under the Rivers and Harbors Act, it needs to be navigable, as the United States conceded on pages 78 to 79 of the record. And here, the existence of ferry traffic does not establish such navigability, again, going back to the Oklahoma case, where navigability turns on whether or not there is sufficient depth to have boats of sufficient draft to ascend and descend the river, that is, go along it, not simply go across it. Because navigability turns on whether it's used as an interstate highway. And Your Honor could cross under I-10 here in New Orleans, but you wouldn't describe it as use of the interstate highway. Instead, use of the interstate highway would be driving from New Orleans to Houston. So that's what's meant by this particular statute. And the United States, as the master of its complaint, has chosen to sue under this particular statute. So the ferries by themselves are not sufficient. No one says that there is currently commerce in the way that I just described it, because as Your Honor just noted, the commerce is crossing it, it's illicit, but most importantly, it's on foot. And under Oregon, just being able to ford a river does not make it navigable.
You said that the U.S., are the mics working?
No.
So we're not recording
that. Can we remedy that?
I'm happy to continue, but I do worry that this is not being recorded.
It's now time. Now, just a minute.
Let me stop. You mentioned that the U.S. is the master of its complaint. I want to take you on a procedural direction. The events of this case took place in Del Rio, not Austin?
They took place in Eagle Pass, which is downriver of Del Rio.
Okay, this was proceeded in Austin?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the United States' choice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I understand correctly that in Austin, these cases are assigned not randomly, but it was selected by the judge who heard this case?
I'm not familiar with how the Western District assigns its cases, but my understanding is that there is some level of division by the judges.
I think the case management order says that this judge picks. It's not random.
I believe so, yes.
Does that affect our review at all, or do we review no matter what? We review the same, basically.
I believe that you review it the same. How it was assigned to this particular judge should not be relevant to this.
It doesn't matter. It's one shot. You just review the case.
Yes. And in this particular instance, the issue that needs to be reviewed is whether the United States has borne its burden of proof of showing that this is navigable. And that is a question of mixed facts and law under Appalachian Power, page 404, where the standard and the ultimate conclusion are, in the words of the Supreme Court, inextricably intertwined. And here, that district court made a number of legal errors. For example, it relied very heavily on an administrative finding of navigability when that administrative agency itself recognizes at 33 CFR 329.3 and 329.14 that it is a conclusion for the courts. And even if the court were to look to the factual basis of that determination, we're looking at a 1975 report created by the United States Army Corps of Engineers that found that there was unnecessary for the Army Corps to determine that past navigability occurred based on what Judge Willett described in his dissent as applicable treaties and statutes. So we're looking at the same treaties and statutes, whether we're talking the 1975 report or the statutes themselves. And under the Oklahoma case, as well as Economic Light and Power, pages 120 of that case, a statute does not make navigable in law what is not navigable in fact. And that same page 1103 of the record determined that there had been no useful navigation between Roma and El Paso, a distance of about 1,000 miles, or roughly speaking, the distance between Washington, D.C. and Mobile, Alabama.
What is the burden of the United States at this juncture of the case? Because we are still at the preliminary injunction stage, right?
We are at the preliminary
injunction. The burden is not so much as to have submitted into the record summary judgment type evidence. So what is the level of evidence that is required in the United States at this juncture?
A likelihood of success on the merits. And here they have not even offered that much evidence because they rely on this one report and one witness who admitted that he had never seen any commerce. He also admitted that the buoys did not fall within the definition of the terms used in the statute. That's the evidence they offered, and that's insufficient for a
The district court also cited the government witness Sheldon's observation that Texas put a barge alongside the barrier?
To stabilize the river, yes.
Which has 3,000 pounds and then anchors. It sounds navigable, but maybe it's sporadic getting a barge out there once. If at trial the government were to show that there's a pier for the Border Patrol to use Border Patrols up and down this portion, would that be proof that it's navigable? If
no,
there's a pier for Border Patrol boats to go up and down around Eagle Pass, yes or no, giving Section 10 authority to the Army Corps?
Not under the Rivers and Marches Act, because it is not in the words of Rio Grande Dam, which ironically found that just the same river being non-navigable, or Oklahoma, or half a dozen other cases, useful for trade or agriculture. The boats that can float in this water can also, for brief periods, go over land because of the way they're constructed. They are so shallow that they're not able to carry useful commerce, which is part of the reason the district court found in the alternative that the river could be made navigable. But going to Judge Douglas's question on the preliminary injunction factors, the United States didn't offer any evidence on that grounds either, because as Appalachian Power, their strongest case on this point noted, the improvements that wouldn't be necessary have to be reasonable. And they offer no evidence of that whatsoever. And again, ironically, Appalachian Power at footnote 26, in contrasting what would be reasonable versus what would be unreasonable, cited what was required for improving the Rio Grande to make it navigable as an example of what is unreasonable, because it would take many millions of dollars to create a canal. And admittedly, that was a different piece of the river, but it's the same problem, which is too many rocks and not enough water. The only reason we have water in this stretch is because of the irrigation infrastructure that only puts it about 18 inches deep. And there has been some suggestion that they could just, well, reprioritize the water. But the priorities are set by treaty, and frankly, there's just not enough water. So as a result, to get useful traffic, it would be completely unreasonable. To illustrate that, I will point this Your Honor, to the Crow case, which was from 1972, or roughly contemporaneous with the 1975 report upon which the United States has relied. And in that case, the United States offered evidence that it would take a 9-foot-deep, 100-foot-wide channel for useful traffic, and that is to make the Rio Grande, which is 200 feet wide, but only 18 inches deep, to have that size of channel would be a massive undertaking that would have, in the words of that same report, serious ecological concerns. Now, the United States has responded to that by saying, well, in other cases, it was 2 to 3 feet deep was all that we needed. But at that time, we were talking about a different type of commercial navigation, and they were talking about improvement at the time when you were using frontier canoes. To say that was still the definition of reasonable creates an anachronistic mismatch between a situation where it would have been improvable for canoes based on technology to blacks out a canal that is that only exists in a time when we're no longer using canoes. And that is a situation that would create a rule that any body of water in this circuit would be navigable, which is inconsistent with Sackett.
If your argument's correct, would any future president be unable to solicit proposals to build a wall, a similar buoy wall, without permission from Texas? Would the President of the United States and his Army Corps be unable, without permission from Texas, to build a buoy wall?
No, Your Honor. And this goes to some of the very cases that they cite, which is there is a difference between what would be within the precedent with the federal government's power and the statute that they have enacted or cited. The President has numerous foreign affairs powers under the Youngstown Test that might allow them to build that wall. However, the question here is whether Texas also has that authority, and it does.
Human trafficking, is it correct that at this preliminary stage no one is relying upon human trafficking either as a basis for Texas's actions or the United States' position? Is that correct?
That would be, Texas has relied on trying to prevent the infiltration of violent cartels which are involved in human trafficking for our equities argument, but they are not, to the best of my knowledge, relying on human trafficking to establish commerce.
Okay. What about drownings? The district court seems to have made a point about drownings, which I understand were not at this point and were not related to the Border Patrol or, but the district court has this in one of its opinions. Is anyone relying upon prevention of drownings for either Texas's position or the United States' position? It seemed that the district court alluded to this, but it just seems to be an illusion.
It is an illusion, which is highly problematic because there's no evidence of drownings in this record at all for good reason. There were a couple of bodies found in the vicinity of the buoys, but they were not found to have been related to it at all. Tellingly, I would point your honor to the United States' witness, Mr. Gomez, at ROA 476 and 1379, where he admitted there were no concerns to human safety. That question was also discussed by our witness, Mr. Escalon, at page 1275 and 76. These buoys are monitored 24/7, so that there is no concern for safety.
Do they make it safer because people are not trying to pass it in a place that's not suitable?
Indeed, that's your own honor. That was the purpose of the buoys, is to try to encourage people to pass into this country via a lawful point of entry, which is at a bridge, and you can't drown on a bridge.
And has it been successful? Has it made it safer?
That's difficult to determine, Your Honor, but we are not aware of anybody who was harmed by the buoys, and in a different case, again, that's not before it, the district court in question did suggest that by the various means that Texas has used to channel to people to the lawful ports of entry, that it hasn't had made it safer.
How do we determine the effect of training of economics and navigation on the Rio Grande? Some statement of not evidence that the federal government about 100 years ago, whatever it may have been, railroads made it uneconomical to improve certain parts of the Rio Grande River as well. Generally, how does that factor in our analysis of whether the river could be made navigable in a reasonable economic way? Is it only today, and how economic it would be today, or it would have been economical 100 years ago, except for railroads?
Your Honor, I think that it's two separate questions. If there had been an effort to improve the river at the time it would have been useful in the 19th century, then that could be considered in terms of navigability. The fact that it wasn't, and that the only situation where anybody actually traveled up through Eagle Pass was a military expedition in the 1850s and nobody went back, suggests that at the time it would have been unreasonable. Today, however, you could still theoretically, under their view, admittedly not ours, but to take your point of your question, you could make it navigable today. It would need to be useful for commercial activity today, not would have been useful today based on boats that haven't been used in 100 years.
What are you basing that on? What case law says you're looking at today on whether it could have been made out of, whether it could be made out of water as opposed to whether it could have been made out of water at another time?
I'm looking at Appalachian Power for that, which says that it is reasonable based on when the improvements would have been useful. So an improvement for a canoe today would not be useful because there's no commerce in Texas that's being done by a canoe. Whereas if an improvement for a canoe in the 19th century would have been useful. That's also been codified in the put like a register in the same language. There are no further questions on navigability, touching briefly on the obstruction and structures issue. The United States has equated the obstruction and the structures question and actually defined structures as anything that creates an obstruction. That's a problem under the statute of statutory language because under Section 9 and Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, the Congress has been very specific about what types of things require a congressional permission slip, what types of things require an Army Corps permission slip, and what types will require both. And here, there's, to the extent they're distinguishing them at all, they're saying obstruction is a broader term than structure, which doesn't make a lot of sense, because that requires Congress to approve more than what would be required to be approved by the Army Corps. So that's a flip-flop. So in the structures category, they've admitted, and their own witness admitted, that the buoys do not fall within his understanding of any of the relevant terms, which is why they're missing a lot of reliance on the term other structures. But reading that phrase in its larger statutory context suggests it has to be a more limited notion than it might otherwise if those two words had been used in isolation. And the genus of structure that issued all poke out into the river and obstruct traffic. Now, or impede traffic, to try not to use the same word. That goes to even their own definition of boom, and their preliminary injunction says something that goes across the river. The buoys do not do that. In fact, their own witness admitted as much, that you can pass by buoys with ease. The district court said, well, you have to take notice of it, so therefore it's an obstruction. That's inconsistent with page 250 of the Wilson case, and I'm quoting here, if vessels can freely pass between the piers of a bridge, it seems to us that the common right of navigation is preserved. So the notion that you're going to have to observe and to go around things in a river is well established in Admiralty law and not displaced by the Rivers and Harbors Act. It's not also not an obstruction, as that term has been interpreted in, for example, the Republic Steel case, because it hasn't tended to destroy the ability to use ships in the river. Now that's a bit of a metaphysical question because there are no ships in this river, but the buoys are only at our view 4 feet. The district court view 16 feet wide in a 200-foot wide river, and the testimony is it's on the shallower end. So you would be traveling on one side of it regardless. That is not tending to destroy whatever ability there is to go to Judge Higginson's questions for boats on the Customs and Border Control to pass them. There are no further questions?
Well, it would certainly obstruct if navigability can be shown by traffic from Mexico to the U.S. The whole point of the structure is to stop that human illicit narcotics traffic.
It would obstruct it for that 1,000 feet. That doesn't tend to destroy the navigability because it's a 1,200-mile river.
That's assuming the rule is highway up and down.
Yes.
My point is every border river, we're primarily talking about commerce between states or between countries. But factually, the full architecture of this barrier system starts with a 3,000 pound cement anchor, then, correct me if I'm wrong, then has 40 feet of chain, and then you get to the floating buoys, is that correct?
Not exactly, Your Honor. The 40 feet of chain is largely on the bottom of the river because that is to allow the buoys to raise if there's a flood. For the most part, the chain is only about 18 inches deep because that's how deep the water is. I would push back on the premise that the border traffic is primarily across between the countries, and for that, I would point Your Honor to the 1848 treaty upon which my friend has relied significantly. And I point Your Honor specifically to Article 6, although we have focused very heavily on Article 7 in this litigation, that I think Article 6 really tells you what you're talking about in terms of navigation. Because at the time, pre-Gadsden purchase, there was a need to be able to travel between different pieces of property, not then belonging to the United States. And Article 6 talks about navigation between those as along the Colorado River and into the Gulf of California. That is, as we described it, using it like I-10, not crossing from the U.S. into Mexico, which is actually specifically forbidden without the consent of Mexico. If there are no further questions, I ask that you remain out of reverse, and I'll see you in a few minutes.
Based on the record at the time. There was a question about drownings. Really, the drownings goes more to harm, irreparable harm. There was evidence here that any obstructions of the river, including this obstruction, could impair response times of the Border Patrol, because the Border Patrol does rescues on the river. From 2018 to 2023, the testimony in the Owens Declaration, this is in the record at 1041, was that they conducted 249 rescues, and there were 89 water related deaths in that period, and the Border Patrol testified, the declaration was that this could impair response times to those rescues. On the, there was a brief discussion at the beginning about the invasion and the political question doctrine. And I think it's important here to consider two things about that. First is the arguments actually made at this stage in the context of those arguments. All that Texas has argued at this point is that the constitutional issue should inform this court's consideration of the statutory issue. Constitutional avoidance is the only thing that they've argued. And if you look at the Nielsen case from the Supreme Court, immigration-related case from a few years ago, Justice Alito opinion, the court says it's not going to consider constitutional questions, you know, in that context, where the only argument made is that it ought to enforce the statute. I mean, just as here, it's, even their constitutional concerns are offered as just another pillar in an argument for the preferred reading of the language of the statute. And so the question is the statute ambiguous? Because constitutional avoidance doesn't come into play, it's not. And here, the Rivers and Harbors Act is not ambiguous. Texas is just arguing that its conduct ought to be excused from the act, or that the facts of its conduct don't fit the act. So that the entire constitutional issue really isn't presented before the court at this point. It's only, you know, whether the Rivers and Harbors Act is ambiguous. And as we've described, it's not. The second point I wanted to make on that is on the political question doctrine, there's no political question that is tied up in our claim. A Rivers and Harbors Act claim based on a structure is the same no matter what the structure or the context is. The only political question that could arise in this case is inserted by Texas as a potential defense, which they've raised only in the context of the preliminary injunction so far. This constitutional issue. And so what the district court said, I think correctly, is that you cannot defeat a claim that doesn't present a political question by inserting your own political question and then saying it can't be reviewed as a defense. And I think that is entirely correct. And Baker v. Carr says it's the political question doctrine, not the political cases doctrine. And so I think it's very important that, I mean, even that arises in the context of this constitutional avoidance argument. So I don't think it's grounds at this point for dismissal. I think those were the affirmative points I wanted to make. I'd welcome the first questions.
So I wonder what you do with Common Cause versus Reacher, which was a 2019 decision of the Supreme Court having to do ultimately political gerrymandering. That case raised not only political gerrymandering, but several other issues, including equal protection violation, First Amendment, Article 1, Section 2, and the elections clause. But the Supreme Court said that it's non-justiciable as a political question, and so the court said the case was, quote, remanded with instructions to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. That, of course, meant dismiss the entire case, including the issues that weren't bound up in the political question.
Right, but I think the political question, you know, the claims itself were inextricably intertwined with the political question there. The claims are what raised the question. Whereas here, as I said, the Rivers and Harbors Act claim will be the same no matter who built the structure or what the structure was.
But every claim has to do with Texas' invocation of its undeniable war power in the event of here an alien invasion. So you can't ignore that. If it's non-justiciable, then the action that Texas has taken stands unmolested because it can't be reviewed. Even the district court agreed with that.
Well, I think the district court agreed that it can't be reviewed, but certainly didn't agree that Texas's actions, what the district court held, and I think correctly, in line with the California case, the New Jersey case, the Potabon case, and including a case from this circuit, also involving immigration, is that whether immigration can rise to the level of invasion is a political question that is beyond the court's competence. But that doesn't mean that the claim cannot be decided. The political question doctrine is not a sword that a state can use to unbind itself from all of federal law.
But excuse me, are you saying that federal law overcomes the constitutional right of the state?
That's not what I'm saying. I mean, I do think the state has to hear where there's no conflict. We've talked about there's no conflict between Texas's asserted rights in the federal statute. Texas is obligated, we certainly haven't established a conflict, obligated to go ahead and comply with the statute by, for example, seeking permission, seeking a permit.
So, assuming that the question of invasion is non-justiciable, which I believe you agree with, then under what circumstances can the United States thwart that attempted self-defense?
Well, I think...
I think it probably would be,
although, there's some, Sterling and Constantin, says these questions can be reviewed in some circumstances and that a governor can't. You don't just rely on the fiat of the governor to overcome the Constitution.
What's your best case for that proposition? I mean, personally, I haven't gotten interested in this until Judge Smith raised it, but now I'm interested.
Well, certainly is the best case, I think on that. And
right, so let me follow up with a procedural question and a subsequent question on the invasion issue. Procedurally, hypothetically, if a citizen were to sue the President of the United States because they were injured bodily or their property was injured due to the President's implication of Commander-in-Chief power, some sort of military action. Would DOJ argue that that was barred, that assault or trespass claim was barred by political question? Or are you telling me that DOJ would not make that argument?
I don't know if it would. I think we would certainly have various defenses to that.
Including political question
would probably be, I'm guessing would be one of them. I haven't thought of the question deeply.
There's plenty of evidence that DOJ would and has and repeatedly makes the political question. Right, let me make a substantive question real quick. As I understand the debate between both sides on the invasion issue, there's a lot turning on this 1874 exchange of correspondence between the Texas governor and the Attorney General of the United States. You cite pages 13 through 15 of the House of the Congressional Report, and I think your theory is that these were sovereign Mexican actions rather than private Mexican actions. So I looked at pages 13 to 15. Don't these figures say the exact opposite? That these are private actions to which the Mexican government simply didn't help those United States citizens who were hurt?
I don't think we were characterizing that as sovereign, or meaning to characterize that as sovereign action. I think it was, definitely an armed incursion by Cortina's men, who, I think, as you're saying, with the permission of the Mexican government or acquiescence of the Mexican government.
The action of the Mexican government.
Correct.
So these were, you agree, these were private raiders, I think is the term that's used, marauders, raiders.
Right. I mean, and on the merits of the substantive question, I think, you know, you need, we explained it in other cases, you know, you need some sort of hostile, organized force, you know, in direct challenge to
the other cases. So, do any of these cases talk about this 1874 incident?
No, I don't think so. I think that was something that Texas raised that we were responding to.
Understood. It was raised in this report as well.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think we take issue with the fact that there could be circumstances where you have an armed hostile force that might trigger temporary powers in the state, but it's not, you know, once the federal government is responding, you know, the war powers are dedicated to the federal government and the Constitution, and in the states, their argument is once we say invasion, we can do anything we want for as long as we want. We don't think that's right, even if there are some circumstances.
Well, the federal government has the constitutional power to take over the National Guard. But I take the governor's statement that the AG agreed to. Until that happens, the governor has the quote right under this clause.
Well, they checked with the federal government, and the governor said, if you disagree, then you know, obviously I'll call this off. So I think
the president understands the president can federalize
federal government is ultimately the one in control here. And here, you know, they put Louisiana River relief to take them out. The federal government's made its position known. And of course, on immigration writ large, the cases are uniform that immigration is not the kind of armed hostile invasion that, you know, the Constitution is talking about.
Mr. Gray, on navigability.
Yes.
You said at the start, of course, both sides are prepared to present any evidence and any theory going to navigability at trial, which is fast upcoming. But based just on the PI record, could you answer yes or no whether the government's defending Judge Ezra's likely navigability on any of the following theories? One, that border rivers necessarily involve commerce that navigates across them. I'm not worried here by Tugwell and Wild. Are you defending that as commerce that can support Section 10 authority?
Yes, there's evidence of that.
Just because of time, I'm going to interrupt you, because I just want to make sure I can ask what theories you're urging. Are you urging that the likelihood of navigability finding is supported also by the fact that Texas erected the buoy barrier to stop illicit human and narcotics trafficking across? Is the illicit commerce itself supportive of Section 10 authority?
We have not made that.
You have not made it. Okay. Third, are you presently arguing that the district court's observation on page 18 that a government witness observed a barge alongside it? Are you arguing that that supports at least a likelihood of present navigability, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, and last, I'm sure the answer is no here, but are you arguing that the Rio Grande water itself that's traveling the full length of the highway that we owe by treaty to Mexico is commerce that the Army Corps has to maintain by dredging, the water itself?
I don't think we've argued that the water itself.
Okay.
Is commerce. I do want to make a comment about the highway language, because that comes up a lot, and I think there's a significant risk of anachronism there with highway, because we think of a highway as, you know, an interstate highway or a major thoroughfare, but, you know, at the time these cases were decided, highway had a more general meaning. If you look at the 1824 Webster's Dictionary, it really just means a public way, and could be as small as something like a footpath, but it's something that connects places. And so this cross-river ferry traffic that we had, significant cross-river ferry traffic, so significant that we had rival companies that filed suit against one another, and it was important enough, lucrative enough, that they took it to the Texas Supreme Court. And so there was a highway across the river, at Eagle Pass there, connecting it with Mexico, over which foreign commerce was traveling. And that ought to be enough. Especially at the preliminary injunction stage, to bring the river within the Rivers and Harbors Act definition of navigability. Unless there are questions about obstructions, I think it's an obstruction to the river. It doesn't have to be a major obstruction in order to qualify.
I have a question. So are you conceding it's not a structure, but that it is an obstruction?
No, I'm not conceding that. We think it's both a structure in the river that's unpermitted and an obstruction to the navigable capacity of the river. It's both of those.
Is that the complete answer to Judge Graves' question? I don't want to step on the question.
That's a complete answer.
In your view, what is the single best piece of evidence that shows this section of the river is navigable?
I think the best evidence is the evidence of ferry traffic, because it's commerce, it's foreign commerce, it's conducted on the river. The test is customary mode of trade or travel. I mean, ferries had gone into mythology by the Greeks, right? I mean, it is one of the most customary modes of trade is to ferry across rivers. And so I think it squarely meets the test, and that's the best evidence. It's not the only evidence, but it's the best evidence.
If a ferry crosses Edible Pass, does that mean the entire river navigable?
Not the entire river, but it would mean the relevant segment.
And what's the relevant segment?
Well, here the Corps of Engineers defined the segment as roughly, I think it's mile 210 to 16. It's roughly 335 mile segment, but it's based.
That means the ferries are 335 miles wide.
No, it's the river segment is based on the geographic qualities of the river and where there are changes. So in Appalachian Power, for example, the court divided it into three segments. The segment at issue was about 50 miles or so, and it was based on there are falls down here, there are falls up here, and this is sort of its own section. And so the character of the river is basically the same.
Are there waterfalls in the Rio Grande?
I think there is one place down the river where there is this gets into a bit more of the evidence we've developed for trial, but there's one place down the river that, folks said, this is a small fall that is the main obstruction, and that's the place we have to correct if we were going to improve this area, but it's generally known.
What's your evidence that ferries cross at this point of the river?
Well, the tugboat case involved the Eagle Pass Ferry Company crossing at Eagle Pass. I don't know if it's in the 1,000 feet, I don't know if we have evidence of that, but certainly it's in this relevant stretch of the river where there's
why isn't that a fatal problem for your theory? If the ferries are crossing at Eagle Pass and not in this 1,000 feet stretch, why isn't that in the case?
Well, because the relevant question is not, you don't look at tiny little segments. In Utah, says this, you look at, are there general characteristics of navigability in the area? And so you don't have to say, well, carry across, right exactly here. But Eagle Pass, I think, is sufficient to demonstrate that.
Well, you don't have to look at the exact path, the exact 1,000 feet, if you're talking about navigating up and down. But if you're talking, if your whole theory is that there are ferries crossing from point A to point B, 90 degrees across the river, then I would think you would need to have some theory as to why this would impede ferry traffic at Eagle Pass.
No, it makes the relevant stretch of the river navigable, and that's not all we have. We do have evidence of some up and down river traffic, and we have the evidence of, Congress passing statutes to preserve its navigability.
I don't want to test your ferry theory. I mean, I don't want to resort to hyperbole, but I could imagine a lot of border streams and creeks, as opposing counsel suggested, where you could have friends just ferrying in a small rowboat Girl Scout cookies. And that sounds sort of absurd, but what's your limiting principle? If ferry commerce is sufficient, and let's take it away from a border river situation, certainly the Army Corps can't go and dredge every creek where there is regular commerce of that nature.
I think the border river is sort of key.
I know. Okay, so you are.
I think that you the key here is that it is foreign commerce carried out on the border river.
That's critical to the test.
I think that's critical to the test, yes.
I have a question up here, right up front. Kane is two questions. Are you principally arguing that the navigability question is a
factual one, thus your lead about clear error?
Correct.
All right, hold it. That's all I want that part. Okay, so allow for the possibility if the court were firmly convinced that we would be 17 strong here on the question. So assuming that volley has not hit the target totally, then even if it is fact-bound, allow that there are voices that feel that the fact-bound determination may be permeated with legal error. And so as you well know, that's first. My question is, assuming the whole is fact, clear error doesn't land at the target, what's your best reliance that there's no legal error? And I temper that, there is an argument brief that the district courts relied on a number of precedent that the Supreme Court had abrogated, is no longer good law, et cetera. So my point is, putting aside being a purely fact issue, the argument being that the court's fact determinations are affected by error legally by relying on cases that are no longer good law. So I just want to know what your position is on that beyond the fact. From?
I think I do follow you. I think what I would say is that the Supreme Court has not explicitly or implicitly done anything to call into question their decisions in Economy-like power or their decision in the Appalachian power. There's no legal error in relying on the navigability test that started with Danny Ball and were developed through the Montello and Appalachian power and Economy-like power. They may, Texas sort of seems to suggest, well, maybe the Supreme Court might rethink this if it had the chance, or, you know. But they haven't done so, and the court is bound by those cases, as well as the district court.
If you were on our court, what would you write in response to Judge Willis' sitting opinion?
Good question.
If I were on the court, what would I write in response to Judge Willis' dissenting opinion? I would write that. I'm sorry, but I would write that the opinion fails to take into account the clear error standard on navigability, and that it does not give sufficient credit to the harms as articulated by, you know, our witnesses. Those would be my main objections. That
isn't there some clear error though, because the district court said it was a boom. And the government doesn't even argue that. So, and ignored the witness that talked about that. So, isn't that error?
Oh, no, the government, and certainly we argued in the district, and there was one witness at the, you know, hearing who testified he didn't think it was a boom. That's true. But our argument was that it was a boom. We've argued it was a boom here. Yeah, it was our witness. But that's not, you know, some sort of binding.
So
we
maintain that it is?
Yes, we maintain that it is a boom. I mean, a boom is a strong chain, you know, linked together to block passage. That's exactly what this is. This is chains, you know, linked to these floating structures anchored by concrete designed to block passage. If it's explicitly within the definition, but even if it's not, it's still an other structure. I mean, it's a structure under the Act. So I don't think one witness's response to one question at an emergency preliminary injunction hearing bound the federal government on that question.
The Supreme Court has described booms as an object that crosses the channel of a river and entirely fills it, in the Bellingham Bay Boom Company case.
Well, I mean, I think the normal definition of a boom is that it blocks passage in some way. But you have booms that go out into the river to sort of block logs from coming down. But there's all sorts of booms. They don't necessarily have to stretch across. But
do you concede there is error at all in the district court's opinion?
No. I don't see any error, particularly not on this question. I think it's...
On any question?
No, I don't concede any error.
Was the district court wrong in talking about news stories about drownings?
I don't know that we certainly didn't argue for that. I don't know that affected its legal analysis in issuing a preliminary injunction. I entire instrument. I don't think I would have speculated on that.
Mr. Gray, let me ask you a quick question about your fairy theory of manageability. And it kind of relates to Ms. Pettit's introductory remarks. Can ferry traffic be part of interstate or foreign commerce without being evidence of navigability?
I don't think so. Because the ferry traffic is carried out on water in a customary mode of trade.
I ask because the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that a river is navigable if it is or if it was or if it's susceptible to being used as a highway of interstate or foreign commerce. And the Corps has also suggested that ferries do not use rivers as highways. It is said that ferry traffic crosses the highway that's formed by the navigable river. That ferry traffic is a continuation, not of the river, but of the highway on one side of the river to the other side of the river. So, seems to me, no matter whether interstate ferry traffic or foreign ferry traffic is part of commerce, if it doesn't use the river as a highway, as Ms. Pettit described, then it's not evidence of navigability.
Well, I think this again goes back to what my discussion a little bit earlier about the highway, and I don't think it necessarily, you know, carries the same meaning that we think of today. And I think that cross river ferry traffic explicitly for foreign commerce, for at least that segment of the river, is established on the highway for commerce between those two points, even though it's a small one. And so I don't think that you can just exclude ferry traffic, altogether. I mean, it's clearly commerce. The question is, does the Rivers and Harbors Act bring it within, Congress's power to regulate under that statute? There's no reason to believe that Congress would not have wanted to prevent obstructions to cross-river commerce carried out on the water in the Rivers and Harbors Act any less than it would want to prevent obstructions of the
Have there been any cases that have excluded ferry traffic altogether?
I'm not aware of anything that excluded it. It was considered both by this court in the Fuente-Reynosa case and by the Supreme Court in Appalachian Power. I guess there's the Crow and Hope case.
That's a Northern District of Georgia case?
Northern District of Georgia case, where the river was the Chattahoochee River entirely within the state of Georgia. And so the cross-river ferry traffic was not engaged in interstate or foreign commerce, but that's the only case that I know of that discounts ferry traffic completely.
You're not relying on what, remind me your position on the warm boats or the troll boats. You said your best evidence you can cite that.
I think that is evidence. I think the ferry traffic, because it was specifically commerce, was the best evidence. But the border patrol boats, Appalachian Power says, it doesn't matter if there's not commercial traffic, if there's other traffic on the river that shows that there could be commercial traffic, and I think the Border Patrol boats, in response to Judge Higgins' question, the Texas barge, the canoe company, that operate on the river, these all show that there's sufficient water in the river for, the simpler types of commerce. Thank you. We would ask the court.
Thank you, Your Honors. And to pick up on the standard of review point, again, I would point this court to page 404 of Appalachian Power. It is a fact question, but in there, the court indicated that both the standard and the ultimate conclusion involve questions of law inseparable from the particular facts to which they are applied. So it's a bit of a quirky factual question. And here, there are numerous fact and legal errors that are included or that are built into the district court's factual finding. First is that it relied so heavily, in fact, I would say exclusively, on cross-river traffic. And I'd like to pick up on Judge Willett's point on that particular question, as well as Judge Douglas's. It's not the question of whether ferry traffic is excluded. It's the basis for whether it is relevant, but whether it is sufficient to act as and to be a highway of interstate commerce. And if a ferry were sufficient, the Appalachian Power case would have been a lot shorter, because there was ferry traffic there too. but instead the court went to considerable effort to note 14 documented instances where there was downriver traffic. And that's the type of language that's used for navigability all the way back to Federalist Number 2, where our first Chief Justice, John Jay, described the our blessings of navigable waters that tie our nation together.
What was the posture of that case, the procedural posture of that case, and does it mean, was it different from this, and does that make a difference or not?
It does not make a difference for the purposes of what the legal standard is.
What was the procedural posture of the case once that finding was made?
I don't remember off the top of my head, Your Honor, but it does, for the purposes of the legal, standard, if cross-river traffic had by itself been sufficient, then it would have been not been necessary for the court to go to such length to describe all of the times that he both traveled down the river, tying our nation together, in Chief Justice Jay's words. In terms of the boundary water, that's not tying the nation together, that's dividing us. And that
was... So you're saying, just for our three states, the state being the river between Texas and Louisiana, lots of ferry traffic. The Pearl River on the other side, Louisiana and Mississippi. You're saying the Army Corps does not have Section 10 authority to dredge to continue that interstate commerce?
Not at all, because there's also downriver traffic.
It has to be always downriver. There has to be under the theory of Section 10 authority.
Under Section 10, I think that's right. There are, for example, the Clean Water Act, which gives additional authority. It talks about boundary waters. That's cited in SACIT. I think it's 33 U.S.C. 1370, but I could have that wrong. There's actual specific provision granting boundary waters.
You agree? Border rivers primarily involve navigation back and forth.
No, Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree with that. For example, the Mississippi is the border between a lot of different states, and there's traffic all the way down. In fact, there are websites that actually allow you to track in real time the traffic that goes down in Mississippi. That's the length on the Rio Grande, because there's no travel that's going down the river. And going to the question that we had briefly about what is preventing the traffic down here, to your question, Judge Oldham, there are falls in the Rio Grande. In fact, there is a fall right above the Laredo, which is what has prevented river downriver traffic above the Laredo from time immemorial, and why the head of the navigation is at Roma, which is downriver of the Laredo. Going to the question of whether this is impairing government function by that, or my friend mentioned that, I would point your honors to page 1001 of the record, where it's discussing whether this is impeding cross-border border patrol. All it says is it could, not that it has. And in this instance, if you're talking about trying to prevent, there are a number of questions about our right to self-defense, you would at least expect at some example where it actually has impeded them. To the contrary, a number of the witnesses, and I'm looking at ROA 445-46, and ROA 491 has said it is not impeding government functions. And going to the invasion question that Judge Jones is now interested in, on page, I point your honor specifically to page 403 of the Sterling opinion that my friend cited that says that these issues are sometimes reviewable. What it actually said was in that instance, no military necessity from any point of view. The review that they are talking about is a good faith review. Unless you can say under no circumstances is this an invasion, the court can't look at it. And I would point your honors to the very helpful article that was from Professor Nadelson, cited by the Constitutional Right and Legal Defense Fund, amicus brief, which describes why that standard can't be met here, because the term invasion was actually used to describe immigration from Connecticut to Pennsylvania in 1755.
Ms. Beth, Chief Judge Richmond asked about the border patrol boats. What's the state's response to that?
The state's response is that border patrol boats on their own cannot show commercial navigability because they are not commerce.
Thank you for the reference to the article. Are there any cases that would describe as an invasion?
I'm not aware of any cases. The cases to which my friend was citing actually were political question justiciability cases. And the Padovan case, when it was opining that this was not an invasion, actually was pre-Steelco and assumed the jurisdiction in a way this court couldn't have.
And the district court said that the question of whether it was an invasion is non-justicial. You've told us that.
Yes, Your Honor.
You agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So whether it's an invasion or not is not something that we can or should be removed.
Yes, Your Honor, unless they can have a heavy showing in Sterling that there is no condition under which it could be considered an invasion, and they have not even attempted to do so.
Counsel, I know your time is up with Chief, and I have one more question. Let me ask this. You said that the structural bolts were sufficient because it's not covered. It seems to me that's not the question. It's whether the bolts themselves are equivalent to the kinds of bolts that we'd be able to use in Congress. Do you have a response to that, whether the draft is about the same size or whatever else? So you don't have to show Congress, you just show it's possible.
I agree with the general legal part, but the boats that we're talking about are boats which have very couple of inches of draft. Modern commerce has to be something like several feet. And here we would have only about 18 inches worth of water, and that's not sufficient for commerce. And the existence of these border boats is not at this point.
Where is that work?
The 18 inches to 3 feet. That is on page ROA 1280. There are also some very helpful photographs on 1021 and 1020, where you're actually seeing the people who are installing this water, these buoys walking in the water, and you can see their knees. There are no further questions. We ask that you reverse.
Thank you. We'll take a